sometimes you just need to make the work that you foresee yourself actually doing for a job. I feel like the more passion projects I do, the more it ends up crossing over into the paid work.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Canon Combos, where we talk to some of the most inspiring photographers and filmmakers across Australia and New Zealand. Today we have Canon Ambassador Kate Cornish, Tilly Rubber and Steph Jowett, who have just completed their incredible film project, The Dykes on Bikes, an origin story. We talk about what goes into the making of a film like that, the importance of collaborating with others, and advice on making your way through the film industry. I think you'll get a lot of insight from these talented filmmakers, so hope you enjoy it. So, I'd love to get to know you guys a little bit because you all, I suppose, have different journeys into the film industry. So, why don't we go through and do a quick introduction to each of you and how you got to where you are now.
So my name is Kate Cornish. I'm currently working as a cinematographer and sometimes director.
I'm Tilly Rubber.
And I'm Steph Jowett. When Canon came with this opportunity to Kate as like a Canon ambassador, she sort of came to us and we sort of collaborated on the idea of this sort of documentary. Me and Tilly sort of work under Studio Antics a lot as co-creators, and we tend to create a lot of ideas and film work sort of together. So we sort of saw this opportunity being under the sort of Canon umbrella and Kate sort of with her cinematography as a way to sort of collaborate on that and, you know, try create something with the sort of cinematography side as well as like the storytelling side and how that's those two sort of entities can sort of, you know, like work together.
Out of all the projects you could have worked on, all the stories you could have told for Canon, why did you choose this one?
Yeah, I think all of us are queer women and we all had talked about the Dykes on Bikes at various stages before this project came about, and we talked about how we're very fascinated in them, and also through bits of what we had found out, we realised that they started patrolling the streets, protecting gay men and trans women, and that was something we'd all kind of been a bit fascinated about. Mm. And it felt important to make this story for, one, like our younger selves, but also to archive a history that even us as queer women didn't know about, so to make sure that other queer people can enjoy it and then straight people, anyone can enjoy it as well. So, yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know the history or who the Dykes on Bikes are, could you give me a little introduction?
It's something that we've been digging into, and the more you get into it, the more it becomes sort of cloudy, and there's so many different, because it's an oral history, there's not a lot written down and people didn't want to document it. But basically in Sydney, in Oxford Street in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of gay men being harassed, murdered and assaulted. And in response to that, a group of women, the Dykes on Bikes, they were called the Vixens then, and also the Dykes on Bikes, came together and started patrolling the streets on their bikes, in their leathers, to protect these gay men and trans women.
I think in terms of like the contemporary sense, like, you know, a lot of Australia knows the Dykes on Bikes as, you know, the opening number in the Mardi Gras parade. And I guess, yeah, it was really important for us to portray them sort of outside of that parade, that, you know, there is a historical significance to them as a group, but they're also throughout the year, they're sort of like doing so many activities together, giving back to the community. And so that was very important for us to see them as a group that is not just attached to the parade, but they're so much more than that.
I guess when you're deciding to tell this story, because from what I'm hearing, it's like, how do you even start to approach that when you look at this huge history behind them, and where do you start when you think, I want to make a short film about this? Where do you even start? So much ground to cover. How do you decide what to focus on?
Well, that's where I come in a little bit here. Because my partner is an official member of the Dykes on Bikes. So through her, we were able to connect with various other members in the club. They also have an official committee. So they have a president, a treasurer, secretary, etc. And so through my partner, we were able to get in contact with those committee members who already are pretty well informed about the history of the club, but also as such have connections to some of the original members who we were lucky enough to get in contact with. One of the founding members, Leslie, and she flew down all the way from Byron to speak with us, which was really special. Unfortunately, a lot of the original members are no longer with us, or, they're either in the midst of illness, mental health issues, etc.
There was a lot of drugs, and a lot of the original members kind of got kicked out of home, so there's some that are no longer with the group or.
Yeah.
Didn't want to talk.
Yeah, I guess also with that, the question you asked, I guess the history is there's so much to it. It's so complex. So I think in terms of how we sort of went about this short film, we wanted to purely just focus on the individuals that we could connect with. And we just wanted to tell their stories and their sort of point of view, because I think to an essence, we didn't really want to talk too much about what we think the history was or our research to the history, because it's so complex and it's so hard to navigate. But we just went, okay, we're just gonna find these people, we're going to talk to them, and we're just going to try take out as much as we can from them and construct a story and a narrative, as well as construct a new history through their perspective. And so I think that's really important.
I think also early chats, we were really wanting it to be cinematography focused, and that we didn't want to have any sit-down interviews, so it was going to be very visual and more emotions-based rather than strictly factual.
Yeah, no talking heads. And I think we made the decision very early on to essentially not use an omniscient narrator or a third-party narrator. We wanted the actual members to almost narrate it themselves with the interviews that we conducted, and then use those interviews to kind of construct the story first, almost like a audio play. And then through that audio play, we planned out what we were actually going to film based on that.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that's also another thing. We kind of actually used the techniques of how you would actually create a animation. So we actually created an animatic. And like Kate said, we had sort of a radio play. We constructed all the interviews together, and then through that we created an animatic, which is a moving storyboard. And then we basically from that we knew exactly what we wanted to shoot, and it created our shot list and stuff. So we actually used techniques from animation to sort of create this hybrid documentary.
That's really interesting, and it does make a little sense to me because I've seen a little sneak peek, and it's amazing. I really love it. I love the use of the motion and the music, the moving portraits, everything, and especially the introduction. That was so cool. And now that you say that, you kind of approach it from an animation standpoint, that kind of makes sense to me because I'm thinking, how do you plan that out? How do you storyboard all of those transitions and cuts and the introduction?
Yeah.
How do you approach something like that?
Yeah. And I think the really cool thing about doing it in that way is that, like, again, another thing that was really important for this was, like, because it's so cinematic, we knew that, you know, to really make that, you know, the cinematic shots even more, like, amazing was music. And so what happens with, like, when we create an animatic, we can actually work with the composer James Brown, and we can really, like, finesse it, and we have this sort of, like, work process with him where, like, we'll show him the animatic and he'll start the music, and then as we shoot, we'll send through the shots to him, and we sort of have, and then we also get inspired by his music. So we actually had a bit of the music before we shot some of it, and then that just helped us get inspired, and then, you know, we add on to that. So it's a pretty cool process and pretty cool relationship to have.
Yeah, I love that. I love collaboration in that way. Whereas, you know, while you're still working on it, someone else in a totally different field is working on their part of it too, and then you can feed off each other. I've worked sometimes like that. Amazing when it works well. Sometimes it's sometimes you get just stuck in a loop where no one has finished anything.
Yeah, it's kind of like that's the good thing about deadlines.
So Kate, tell me about how the kind of techniques you used to film this, because you would have using a C70 as the main camera?
No. I was
okay, take that back.
No, it's okay. I was using a C500 Mark II as my main camera, and then the C70 was used whenever I needed to place the camera on a gimbal. So there's a couple of gimbal shots that occur mainly during this ride we did in Picton, where there's probably like the most amount of Dykes on Bikes members, and we had to rig the camera to a car, so I needed the gimbal for that. And then also I was doing a bunch of tracking shots, kind of like rushing past them, and so the C70 was used for all of that, but the C500 Mark II was our main camera.
So all of the shots during rides were from the car. In my head, I was just picturing you hanging off like someone else's motorbike, like trying to like weave
goodness
in and out
gracious
of
no. That'd be so dangerous.
I just didn't know how else you would film it, because some of these shots, like, they're really close and it's really cool and like rushing up against people. I thought, I'm just trying to picture you doing that. I was like hanging off, like gimbal in one hand and trying to balance on the other hand.
Oh my God, no. No, I have extensive experience being a pillion, which is the person that's on the back of the bike. And
right.
It's hard. Like, being a pillion is a job in itself, because you've got to make sure that your center of gravity is perfect and your feet aren't like getting in the way of the actual rider. Yeah, so there's no way I would have been able to like sit backwards on it without like stunt training or something.
Well, speaking of the gear that you were using, so what made the Canon cameras perfect for this particular project?
I think a few reasons. The first is the ecosystem. So being able to shoot with the C500 Mark II, which is like a beast of a camera, it's full frame, like that was going to be my main camera of choice regardless. But then being able to color match that camera with something a little bit smaller, so I could, you know, pull off those shots that I mentioned before on the gimbal and be able to have that seamless seamlessly like switch between those two cameras throughout the film. That was super useful. So that was one reason, like just, you know, the ecosystem. Also, all of the C70 shots, the lenses used on the C70 were a series of RF lenses. And that was really useful for me too, because we just didn't have the capacity to be having to worry about focus pulling whilst the camera was on a gimbal, like on the back of the car. So I could literally just rely on like the amazing autofocus capabilities of the C70 paired with the RF lenses, and also like the stabilization as well. In that, because they're still, even though it was on a gimbal, that was still a bit bumpy. We were on like a dirt road. So creatively, the reason why I chose Canon, firstly, just the color science is pretty unmatched for this tier of camera. I just needed something like super reliable.
Always handy.
Because we're going to be out in the elements. And as we know, the Sydney weather has not been kind. I just needed something super robust that I could rely on. And also the fact that the C500 Mark II shoots raw, that was super important. To just be able to manipulate the color in post as much as possible, because we're taking a bit of creative license with kind of conjuring up these 80s style, I guess we're going to call them recreation scenes at the beginning of the film. So we're mixing that with the reel, or, you know, the actual documentary footage. And we wanted a distinct look between both. And so we worked a lot with our colorist Alina, and yeah, to be able to present her with that beautiful raw footage was a delight. I think Canon in general is just king when it comes to documentary filmmaking. They just, especially the C300 Mark III, even though I didn't use it for this, but you know, that camera especially is known as an amazing documentary camera, because you have like your internal NDs, especially with the C70. That's so important for like run and gun filmmaking, when again the weather, the exposure is changing like minute by minute. It's just like a great run and gun camera that also delivers a super cinematic image. So yeah.
Which is exactly what you needed for this one. I mean, the amount of kind of different locations you're going through, you're out in the elements, you're attaching cameras to cars. It sounds like, I've seen the final product and it looks very slick, but I always love hearing what the actual challenges were. And and if anything, you know, didn't go according to plan, or you had to come up with a crazy solution to something that went wrong. I mean, I'm assuming something must have gone wrong when you're riding along with dozens of people and you're hanging out of a car. Did that just go perfectly?
I don't want to say anything.
I think the obvious two that come to mind is just COVID being super annoying for scheduling.
Yeah.
And then El Nina. Is it El Nina?
La Nina?
El Nina. Yeah, the rain. We were hoping to get some really beautiful sunset shots, and every time we did plan for it, it rained heavily. And the one time we cancelled, it was actually really beautiful. So
even though it was predicted to storm.
It was predicted to like thunderstorm.
There's not one sunset in the whole damn film. But you know what? Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it like sets the tone. I don't know.
I think that's what we were telling ourselves.
Sunrise.
We did get a really nice sunrise.
Yeah.
One other thing is that the dykes on bikes, some of them don't like their bikes to get wet. So they seem really tough, but then they were like, oh, it's the rain's coming, we better go. So yeah, that was funny.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with it when, like, you know, totally unexpected, unforeseen things happen on set? You know, what's the thought process when you come up against these problems?
You just push through. Honestly, there's nothing you can do. You've organized everything down to the catering for the day. You just honestly have to push through.
I think also, like, embracing the way the weather will change your story is important. Like, leaning, if it's going to piss down, lean into that moody atmosphere or...
Let go of the dreams of sunrises and sunsets.
And we did get some pretty... We ended up doing a shoot kind of last minute, which replaced our sunset, which is the rooftop ride. And we did get some, like, pretty colossal-looking thunderstorm clouds, which in a way is almost just as good as a sunset. It's, you know...
Well, I mean, I like how you've done it, and I like what you've said. You know, just own it. Like, this is what it is now, and let's just make the most of it. And no one would ever know until I listened to this podcast. Like, I didn't know that, you know, it was meant to happen sunrise. I thought it was quite cool seeing slow motion raindrops and people moving through that. It was really cool.
Thank you. That was the intention.
Just no one listen to this, and you'll never know. So who do you want to see this film?
Everyone. No, I really hope that not only, you know, people who are part of the community view it. I think it's important viewing for everyone, as I said before, especially because the film really humanizes these women. And it is quite emotional. Like our colorist said, our colorist Alina, she said that when she was viewing the film for the first time, she fully shed a tear. And I've heard that from a lot of people who've seen it, a wave of emotion does overcome them. So I think it would be nice, like, if people from all walks of life could see it and enjoy it and learn a thing or two.
I think also, it's like a very Aussie story. It's like part of Australian history that, hasn't been told a lot or archived. So it's nice that Australia gets to have that. We both have gay brothers, and that was part of the start for making this. Back in the 80s, the community, the LGBT plus community, used to be kind of more one, and it's started to become a bit divided as the internet and there's a lot more subcultures, which is great, but sometimes it's nice to remember that, like, we're all here with each other, and that... lesbians once looked out for gay men, and yeah, just to remember that and tell that story is nice. So
have you had a viewing for all everyone who was in the film? Have they all seen it?
Yeah, we showed a bunch of the Dykes on Bikes the film at their Mardi Gras after party, and the response was super overwhelming. Like, just, I can't even count how many people came up to me and gave me a hug. They just looked just honored and, like, incredibly happy, because this is the first time that a, you know, official film has been made solely about the club. A lot of them said, I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't think it was going to be good. So, yeah, I mean,
That's the secret to impressing everybody. Just have it. Keep the low bar. Keep the low expectation.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we look like the three of us just look like we won't deliver a good film, but we did. I don't know.
Well, I imagine making something like this is, you know, brings you back to, you know, why you want to make films in the first place. I guess all of us are working in various industries, and a lot of the time you're just creating commercial work for other people. But when you get to work on something personal like this and see the reactions from everybody and see the effect it has on people, did it make you kind of, you know, bring you back to why you even started all this?
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's a nice feeling. It's a nice feeling to make something of importance and make something lasting that feels like it has a purpose. What do you think, Steph?
I was just going to say, I just think it's the most scariest thing to have that responsibility of constructing this film and this story about, a certain group, and then have to like show it to them. Like, that's just like, was really terrifying. I thought it was really like a really terrifying experience. And I feel like, you know, documentaries kind of lead its way to that sort of thing. No, it was very good. And I think afterwards when there was that sort of sigh of relief that they were all very happy with it, that definitely was good. But, yeah, very scary.
I suppose if it wasn't scary, then... I mean, the fact that it is scary, you know, tells you that it was something worth doing and taking risks on. If there was, you know, no chance of disappointing anyone, you know, it probably means it wasn't that important a project, but obviously it is. What's something that each of you learnt from the experience?
I feel like what I learned was, you know, that idea that we were talking about before, with going with the weather, going with the COVID restrictions, you know, all that kind of stuff. And
Letting go.
and
needs to relax.
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess getting more used to that and sort of, you know, I feel like, I don't know, for me, I like come from a background of like, you know, design and you kind of imagine these worlds and you sort of want, you know, it to sort of pan out the way you sort of imagined. But yeah, from this experience, it was very like, you know, kind of just need to go with it, all that chaos.
Yeah, adding to that, because Steph and I are both from like a design background and work in, have done an animation, because we all planned it like an animation. Letting go was, I guess, a good thing, because it is a very structured thing to do a shot list and have it planned out to a T, and then the weather changes. So, yeah.
I think we all learnt each other's strengths and weaknesses in terms of working with one another as well, because I love working with these two. I think they're incredibly creative. They have such a strong vision, and I always want to honor that vision anytime I work with them. And the both of them, as they've just said, like, work very much in that pre-visualized, structured manner, and I'm a bit more of a loose cannon. I am very much like, I adapt to the environment. I'm a bit rogue in that way. Like, I'll see a bird fly by and I'll want to literally take the camera to the bird. So it was a lesson in, you know, playing to each other's strengths and figuring out how to better communicate with one another based on that. Even though we've worked together so many times before, every time we work together is a new learning experience, creatively, in terms of how we communicate with one another. And I think, and I hope that like that will just improve as time goes on and we become a stronger unit because of it. So, yeah, that's another major thing I think we learn. And it's a positive thing.
How do you choose, you know, how do you choose people to collaborate with? Or what kind of things do you look out for when you're picking your crew?
I think my number one takeaway in terms of crewing is making sure I get people on board who do believe in the project and do believe in the cause of what we're making, because that will, you know, deliver a stronger end result.
And how important is it to, you know, work on these personal projects that, you know, don't have commercial backing so much, or aren't really possible without people volunteering time and everybody working overtime for not much.
I think it's super important. Well, I was just going to say, I think it's super important because sometimes you just need to make the work that you foresee yourself actually doing for a job. Do you know what I mean? If you're feeling like the work that you're making for money purely is not fulfilling you, sometimes you just have to make that a reality. Like, I feel like the more passion projects I do, the more it ends up crossing over into the paid work.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more...
Well, people can trust you.
Yeah, exactly.
If you can't show people that you can, then they're not going to just hand you over a job. I mean, I work in both graphic design and then do directing. So it's kind of that thing of balancing, the paid work and then the work you want to make as a storyteller.
Well, I think we've covered everything. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about the film or say to anybody, who encourage people to watch the film?
I believe they can watch it on Canon Australia's official YouTube channel and through Canon Australia's website.
And thank you for chatting. It was really, really awesome to hear kind of all the workings and everything behind the film and what it took to come up with that final piece.
Thanks so much, Jared.
Thanks, Jared.
We appreciate it. I think my one request for everyone watching the film is just remember that these are real people. A lot of them have never been filmed before. And, you know, just remember that before you type anything. These are sensitive souls on camera. It's a very emotional film and it touches on very personal subject matter. Some subject matter that is really hard to hear. So I think if we could just remember that before, writing anything, if you feel so inclined to do so. But that's all I'm going to say. But thank you for watching it.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much and congratulations on the film, and I hope everyone goes out and watches it.
Thanks, Jared.
Thanks, Jared.
Thank you.
That was Canon ambassador and cinematographer Kate Cornish with Tilly Rubber and Steph Jowett talking about their latest short film, The Dykes on Bikes, an origin story. You can check it out on the Canon Australia website and YouTube. Thanks for listening.